Good day, Sanbonani Dumelang, the Afrikaner community. From 1652, they arrived with Jan van Riebeck. But as of recent, whenever you hear Afrikaner, you think of apartheid. But who are they? Who are these, the white community in Africa? As they say, they're Africans by the word Afrikaner. In studio, as we celebrate Heritage Month, we have Ernest Roots. He's a head of policy at the Solidarity Movement. He was previously with AfriForum. He's a lawyer, and he doesn't want me to say that he's a doctor as well. The man has done a couple of things over his life. He has been very active within the Afrikaner community, advocating. And today we have him in studio to do a history checkup. And as we celebrate the heritage of South Africa and the Afrikaner community form part as that community that has built this country, has had history in this country, fraught with the English in this country. Ernest, welcome. How's it?
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. And I'm doing very well, and I'm happy to be here. And I'm happy to be talking about this topic, which, of course, is very close to my heart.
But before you even jump into the politics of the Afrikaner community, let's talk about you, right, for a while. Where are you from, and why are you at the forefront of the Afrikaner community?
Well, I think if I get asked that question, I almost feel like one of the most important things to say is that I'm a plaas jaapie, as we say in Afrikaans. I'm a farm boy.
Okay.
Even though I live in the city, and I've been living in the city for decades now in Pretoria, but I grew up in Zanine in Limpopo.
Wow.
I went to Merensky High School, which is an agricultural high school, and I love that area of the country. And there's always this debate, which province is the most beautiful? And every province is beautiful in its own way. But in my very subjective view, I would say Limpopo is the most beautiful province. In terms of who I am, you mentioned I'm in law, technically in terms of what I studied. I'm very proud of the fact that I'm an Afrikaner. It's something that I take pride in, and I like talking about. I'm a Christian, and I'm a family man. I have a family. I have four boys at home.
Yes,
very lucky. And I think that's probably the most important things that I would think define me.
So when you look at the history of the Afrikaners, right, in 1652, some people were saying you were Holland, you are from Holland. Some were saying, but they are French as well. So the Afrikaner identity, how does it all start? Give me a bit of history.
Maybe I should start with a somewhat funny story, but a very important story. And that's the first time the word Afrikaner was used to refer to the Afrikaner people as a community. It was used before that, but almost as a synonym for African.
Yes.
And today we know Afrikaner and African doesn't necessarily mean the same thing.
So
that it was a story in 1707 in Stellenbosch. There was a youngster, I don't know if he was high school or university age, let's say around 20. And him and his friends they had too much to drink, and they were partying in the streets of Stellenbosch.
Okay.
And they were running around, screaming, making a noise, and disrupting the town in a certain sense, and it was in the middle of the night. And they were then caught and arrested, and they were brought before the magistrate. And the magistrate was very annoyed with these people disrupting the town. And this young person, Hendrik Bibou, was told that he's going to be deported. He's not welcome in this country anymore. They're going to send him to the islands east of South Africa, Indonesia, over there. And he was very upset. And then he said, "You will not deport me because I am an Afrikaner."
Oh.
And he said, "Even if the magistrate beats me to death, I will not leave." And it's a funny story in the sense that the first time the word Afrikaner was used in that context was with a young guy who had too much to drink and was threatened for disrupting the peace. but it's also an important story in the sense that he used this term to say that Africa is my home. And if you send me to some island, to Indonesia or Australia or one of these countries, if you send me there, you're gonna uproot me from my home. And so to get to your question, before that, We know Jan van Riebeeck arrived in 1652. Mm-hmm. He was sent by the Dutch East India Company.
Yes.
But also, as you mentioned, Afrikaners are not just do not just have Dutch ancestry. Mm. Shortly after the Dutch came, there was a large income of influx of French Huguenots,
yes.
French Protestants, particularly who were fleeing the religious wars in Europe,
yeah.
Fleeing persecution in Europe, coming to South Africa. Mm-hmm. And there were also a significant amount of Germans coming to South Africa at that time.
Okay.
And so, and there are other influences as well, some Hungarian and English and so forth, but predominantly. Predominantly the Afrikaner people, if you ask where do we descend from, it's mostly a mixture of Dutch, Germans, and French.
So the language Afrikaans, most people say it sounds more Dutch.
Yes.
Right. But they say there is a distinctive way of to say this is South Africans, Afrikaans. What makes it different?
So I was in the Netherlands last year. And I have to say, it's difficult to follow someone speaking Dutch if you are Afrikaans. Up to a point, and then your ear sort of gets attuned and you can follow a conversation to an extent, but it clearly is two different languages.
Okay.
But there are some similarities. Afrikaans was also influenced by other languages, Malaysian influences, like the word baya we say mm-hmm. for a lot. There's no Dutch word for baya.
Oh.
Baya is from a Malaysian influence. And others, like words like pisang and susati and babuati. There are many Afrikaans words that are not Dutch. It's foreign or strange to the Dutch.
Yes.
But then also, so there's a joke, so somewhat of a joke, that a language practitioner once told me that to a Dutch person, Afrikaans sounds like old Dutch.
Oh.
But to an Afrikaans person, Dutch sounds like old Afrikaans. So there is some words, and we find some of the Dutch words very funny, and they find some of the Afrikaans words very funny.
Yes.
Like what we call a scooter. They call it a snorfiets, which is a moustache bicycle. and I thought that was very funny. And I laughed when I saw that in the Netherlands. And they didn't know why I think it's funny to laugh at the word snorfiets.
Yeah, like a scooter is better.
Yeah, yeah. And so they laugh at the word huisbak. We have the word huisbak, which means lift or elevator.
Yeah.
And to them, that's a very funny word because it's a bucket that goes up, and things like that. So there are some similarities, but I have a friend in the Netherlands who's trying to convince me that Afrikaans is just a dialect of Dutch.
But like me, bro.
It's a bit more complicated than that.
So you guys settled at the time in South Africa, as you know it at the time. You came in with doing a lot of farms and all of that, and the English came along. What was happening there?
So the Van Riebeeck came in 1652, and it was a refreshment station. The idea was for them to have, a piece of land where they would farm and produce, crops, so that the ships traveling, around South Africa, going to the east, to India and so forth, can stop and get fresh water and supplies.
So you're just passing by.
Just passing by, yes.
Then you settled.
and then in, I believe it was 1659, they had the Freiburgers, or the Freiburgers as we know them. Mm-hmm. So what happened is some members or citizens of the Dutch who were employees, the people who stayed there were employees of the Dutch East India Company, and they were then released of their contracts and encouraged to be farmers, to go out and farm so that they could stimulate some form of an economy. Mm-hmm. And obviously there was friction with local tribes. There was a lesser known part of the history is that there was also cooperation.
Okay.
And some people say that was one of the first steps to the development of the Afrikaner people, was not Jan van Riebeeck arriving, but those members of the East India Company who were released from their contracts to say, you must now go and be farmers.
Also, there was an unemployment and they had to do something.
Yeah, something. It's not that they were fired, but they were not employees anymore. So in a sense, you could say they were, but it was a step taken to encourage a local economy.
Okay.
And so that it started growing from there, and then What we didn't know was, or we only got the news late afterwards, mm-hmm. is of course Europe was going through the Enlightenment, and the French Revolution had massive international repercussions.
Yes.
And some of these repercussions, of course, then were the wars with Napoleon and so forth, which led to more aggressive British expansionism.
Yes.
Also to strengthen their navy and so forth. Mm. And one of the consequences thereof was the annexation of the Cape.
Okay.
In, was it 1810, I believe?
Yes,
around
yes.
there.
The Cape of Good Hope.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And so there were some battles, the Battle of Blouberg and the Battle of Meisenberg between, back then they were just called the Dutch, although there were French and Germans also there.
Okay.
And eventually the British annexed the Cape of Good Hope,
okay.
which then became the Cape Colony.
Yes.
And a lot of the people living there were really frustrated by this. They felt like their freedom was taken away. Mm-hmm. They now had another nation governing over them, ruling over them, making decisions on their behalf.
Yeah.
And so they said, we can't accept this. We have to move.
Okay.
Which, of course, led to the Great Trek when these a few thousand of these mm-hmm. which became known as the Voortrekkers, moved
yes.
into the interior of South Africa.
Okay. And at that time, I remember the Anglo-Boer War happened. This is where I think you came head-to-head with the English. Mm. This is like the 1900s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. 1899 to 1902.
What was the battle about? What happened? What informed this war?
So the Great Trek was in the 1800s, around 1836, 1838, around there was when this trek happened into the interior.
Yeah.
And there's also what we know or think of today when we hear the Great Trek. We think about the big battles, like the Battle of Blood River,
yes.
and there were others, the Battle at Italeni and yeah. Vegkop and so forth. But again, as with the Cape and as with our later history as well, I would say some of the most important parts of that history is today neglected when we talk about that, and that's also the cooperation. So there were many treaties signed with local African tribes and cooperation agreements between the Voortrekkers and
yeah, because I remember apparently during this war there were also African people who were fighting on both sides.
Yes,
there were those yeah. who were fighting with the Afrikaners, and there were those who were fighting with the English.
Yeah, during the Anglo-Boer War.
During the Anglo-Boer War.
Yeah.
And as it ended, I think that's when you became successful. Or is this when Della Rey became a celebrity?
Yes. So the Great Trek ended with which was before the war. It ended with the foundation of the Boer Republics.
Okay.
And so where we are sitting today used to be, back then it was called the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek or the Transvaal Republic.
Yes.
And then there was the Orange Free State, and there was the Republic of Natal,
yes.
which is KwaZulu-Natal today.
Mm-hmm.
Natal was then annexed by the British again, which
okay.
was so as they established the Republic, it was annexed. The British came and they annexed it again, which of
okay.
course led to more friction between the Afrikaners and the British.
Mm.
And then a very good thing or a very bad thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably both, and that was that gold was discovered.
Okay.
Gold and diamonds, which gave just this much stronger impetus for the British to control South Africa. And so that's what sparked the Anglo-Boer War. And General Della Rey, who's this big hero today, was one of the big leaders, the generals fighting for the Boers during this war against the British.
Because one would wonder then, as you guys are fighting with the English, was there a consultation with the local communities, were you with the local kings, the monarchs, was there some sort of an agreement or alliance with them?
There was some consultation and conversations, and there was also friction.
Okay.
There was always, it seems, throughout history, there was this friction, but there was also cooperation in some areas. And I think there's a saying, there's a Harvard professor in political science, Professor Samuel Huntington. He made the remark that every nation views the history as the world with themselves as the middle point, as the center point.
Mm.
And so one of the consequences thereof, as I'm sure you know, is that during that war,
mm-hmm.
Tens of thousands of black Africans died as well.
True.
In concentration camps.
Mm.
But as an Afrikaner looking back at the war, it's easy to say, so many people died, and then you only count the Afrikaners who died because that's your people.
yes.
And that's it's something that can easily happen, but it's a dangerous thing to do. And I think that's why engagement between communities is so important. And I think there's nothing wrong with having a sense of pride in your people and what they have achieved.
To your people, yeah.
Yes, but once that becomes some form of imperialism, or once that becomes a denial of pain that was experienced by others, or something along those lines, that's when it becomes a problem.
So there's a part where the English, they throw you into concentration camps. This is before what, the second Anglo-Boer War?
That was, the second. So actually there were two Anglo-Boer Wars, as you say. The first, actually we won, and we're very proud of that because it was the British Empire. It was the strongest empire, the strongest military in the world.
Yes.
And that was in 1881, I think.
Sure.
That war was ended at the Battle of Majuba. At the Majuba Mountain, where the British was on the mountain and General Piet Joubert on the Boer side.
Okay.
They had to fight climbing up the mountain, shooting upwards towards the British. And that battle won the war for the Boers. And then several years later, the British came back in full force. And I read a fascinating book the other day, which might be relevant to mention here. It's a book about the First World War, which of course was it 1914, when it started.
Yes.
And the book is about why did this war happen? If the world has developed scientifically and philosophically and everything up to a certain point with enlightenment and everything, why was there suddenly a world war? And it's very interesting to see what influence the Anglo-Boer War had in the run-up to the First World War, or as one of the causes for the First World War.
Okay.
And there were two major things. One was there was significant European support for the Boers and rejection of the British, or anger or frustration towards the British. Other European nations like the French and the Germans and the Hungarians and all these, and the Dutch, who felt that the British was just being imperialistic. They went and they just had a war that they had no point in being there.
Yes.
So on a moral level, there was a growing rejection of this notion of imperialism, actually.
Okay.
And also, the other reason was that the Boers were able to hold out in this war much longer than everyone expected. So when the war started, the British said that the war would be over before the end of the year or before Christmas. And that was in October 1899. And the British really thought it's going to be a month and then the war's going to be over. And it turned out to be a 3 years war. And so that signaled to the rest of Europe that maybe the British are not as strong. as they want us to believe. But so that's where the concentration camps came in, is during the first part of the war, the British actually thought that they won because they very quickly took Bloemfontein, which was the capital of the Free State, and Pretoria, which was the capital of the Transvaal Republic. And they thought, if you take the capital, you win. But then the Boers, and especially General De La Rey and De Wet and some others, went over to guerrilla warfare, which was, going into the bush and having surprise attacks and so forth.
Okay.
And so the British thought the war was over, but in a sense, it was only the beginning. And that's when they said, we have to take more desperate measures. And they took this decision to start the scorched earth policy, which is to burn down farms en masse and to establish concentration camps and put... Boer women and children and Africans in concentration camps.
So it wasn't only Afrikaners, it was also Africans as well putting in.
Yes, about 20,000 black Africans died during that war as well. Yes.
Okay. Because usually all you hear is that the Afrikaners went to a concentration camp, they fought, they rebuilt themselves, reclaimed. And I think during the apartheid time, someone was saying, but you guys are very much aware of this treatment, but you are equally doing exactly what the English did to you, to the very same black people around you.
Yeah, just to say that again.
So remember, you went through what you call imperialism.
And then they threw
you into the camps.
And now we're doing the same.
You're doing the same thing. Like, but shouldn't you know better? Since we had the same experience.
Well, I think that's a very important question. I think. Look, I can't defend the apartheid system, and I don't intend to. I think there were some differences, but I also think one of the differences was the British decided we need to take South Africa, and we need to come in and we need to conquer these people, and we need to, they need to become subjects of ours.
Yes.
And the apartheid idea, at least the way it was argued initially, was that we need separate homelands for different peoples and, you know, separate development. So everyone's going to have their own piece of land. And and that's, you know, if you read it, it sounds like a wonderful idea. But then if you look at the application thereof, that's really where, that's how you should measure something. You shouldn't measure something by good intentions or what people, because you can say communism, I think initially there were some good ideas, but if you look at the implementation thereof, and apartheid is not communism, there's differences, but I think it's very sad how it played out, and I think it's something I'm very happy to say today that at the time, I mean, I wasn't born. I was born towards the end of apartheid. I can't really remember much of it, but But I think it's fair to say at the time a lot of Afrikaners, if not the majority, thought that this is a good project and we need to support it because it's good for us, and it's good for black people.
But was it more of a demographic issue that if we somehow do this one man one vote, we might end up having black people ruling over us? Or also you're scared of the English maybe coming back again through the back door?
I think it was to an extent both. There's a book called Apartheid, Britain's Bastard Child.
Okay.
And I've only read sections of it, but I have listened to the author speaking about it. And the premise of the book is how the British conduct towards the Afrikaners, some of which we just discussed now, influenced the Afrikaner psyche in terms of this very urgent desire to take certain measures to protect yourself.
Yes.
Because the Afrikaner experience since the British came to South Africa has always been that we're under attack and we need to defend ourselves. Mm-hmm. And now if we have control of the government, we need to implement certain measures to make sure that we
close
are safe.
All ranks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so I think, so the argument at least is that has, it, on a macro scale, a big psychological impact on the Afrikaner people.
Okay.
So I think there's an element of that, but then there's also an element of demographics of saying, okay, well, we are in control of the government to an extent. Initially, it was under the British Empire up until the referendum in the 60s when South Africa became a republic.
Yes.
But there was also this fear of one man, one vote, and saying, well, if we do that, then we're going to lose the state. And then what if they turn against us? And so a good metaphor that I was told by someone who was involved with the National Party at the time, said to me once that it's like sitting on the back of a tiger, and you know I have to get off this tiger. In other words, the system has to end. It's not working. Initially, you could have said, well, maybe we can make this work. And I think by the 1980s, it was very clear, before that perhaps even, but at least by the 80s.
You already knew that it's not working.
Yeah, and it's only getting worse. And so it's like saying, I need to get off this tiger, but how am I going to get off this tiger without getting eaten? and so the question, I don't think by the 1990s, definitely, I don't think the question was really, should we end this? Okay. The question was, how should we end this?
How do we get to the table?
Yes.
But then one would say, was it basically more of the ANC pressure? Was it more of the guerrilla warfare, some controversies, bombings, and international pressure? Do you think if there was no such, it could have ended either way?
So it's both. I think the Afrikaners, but the National Party in particular, lost the moral argument. They were not able to defend themselves morally. But I should also say that one of the other factors, we mentioned demographics and we mentioned the history of the English, but a third one that was very important was communism.
Okay.
It was the time of the Cold War. And when the developments in the Soviet Union became quite clear and we could see, you know, the horrors of communism, you know, the Rooigevaar.
Yes.
And then the ANC came out and said, we're a communist organization. And so, and the response by the National Party was, let's suppress communism, so let's write a law, the Suppression of Communism Act.
Yes.
And so the argument, at least, seems to have been that we need to protect South Africa from communism.
Okay.
But the way that was perceived was, oh, so what you're actually doing is you're repressing freedom of opinion and freedom of speech.
Okay.
And freedom of association.
Yes.
And so this just goes to this tiger that was growing and growing and becoming more and more ruthless.
Yeah, because I remember, even if you go through a lot of history books, they always labeled the comrades at the time, not as freedom fighters per se, but as communists.
Yes.
And they always say, we are fighting against communism. It's not about these guys. It's about the people backing these guys. Was that the mindset of the Afrikaner at the time, that we don't necessarily mind you fighting for your freedom, but we are worried that once you get this freedom, you're going to turn this country into a communist?
Yes, that was a very strong thing at the time.
Okay.
This concern about communism. And I don't think, there's this joke about Roy Gevaar, but I think there's some truth in that because there were some really atrocious things that have happened all over the world in the name of communism,
yes,
especially in the previous century.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another thing that played a role was the Afrikaners regarded themselves and still do as, on a cultural level, as Westerners, as being part of Western identity.
Yes.
And so the West had this the Cold War, you know, between the Soviet Union and America.
Yes.
And
yes,
so the Afrikaners at the time thought, we have a role to play in this Cold War between
solidarity and
alliance. Between the free market and the communists, and we're on the side of the free market, but up to a point. and so they really felt that they had a moral duty to take a stance against communism.
Let's go back for a while. Jan Smuts.
Yes.
Right. Once revered leader of the Afrikaner people, then along the way, then the Afrikaner said, no, he's selling out.
Yes.
What is the debate down there?
That's a very interesting story, and I personally have some conflicted views about Jan Smuts. I think if we talk about the word greatness, and greatness, regardless of whether there's a value judgment or a moral implication, if we just say greatness means having a lot of influence,
yeah,
Jan Smuts was undoubtedly one of the greatest people ever to come from South Africa in terms of the role that he played internationally. He was involved with the founding of the United Nations.
Yes.
There's a statue of him in London next to the British Parliament.
Okay.
He was an incredibly influential person.
Yes.
And what's remarkable, what I see now, part of my job currently is to reach out to other countries and, you know, make friends abroad, is when you go to, when you speak to the English, they talk to you about Jan Smuts and how he advised the British during the Second World War and the incredible role that he played. If you talk to the Dutch, they talk about there was a thing called Operation Manna, which is when the Nazis took over the Netherlands.
Yes.
Jan Smuts organized this initiative for British airplanes to fly over Amsterdam and drop food parcels for the Dutch.
Okay.
And so they talk about Jan Smuts and
as
Operation Manna. Yeah, yeah. And when you go to the Hungarians, they talk about Jan Smuts and the pressure he had put on the communist government there under the Soviet Union.
Okay.
And when you go to Italy and to South Tyrol, the German province in Italy, they talk about how Jan Smuts fought for them to have some form of self-determination.
So he was the Mandela of the time.
Yeah, in many ways. But towards the end of his life, he remarked that my people have rejected me.
Yes.
And that's, I think that goes to your question, because he was, among Afrikaners, he became a controversial figure.
Yes.
Because it was just after the Anglo-Boer War. He was a general during this war. He fought the British.
Yes.
And his conclusion after the war was, the best way forward is for us to accept our place in the British Empire and to become loyal subjects of the British Crown and to contribute to the British Empire.
And that was they didn't go well
and
down.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so the British Empire liked that. And there's a video clip on YouTube, a fascinating video of him speaking in the London Parliament, the British Parliament, during the during the Second World War.
Yeah.
And as he walked in, he just got this standing ovation, and they were cheering. And when he finished his speech, they started singing, "He's a Jolly Good Fellow." So he was this internationally celebrated figure, and he was incredibly intelligent, and he was incredibly hardworking.
Yes.
But his view was that the Afrikaner people should
just be loyal.
We must become we must become British citizens, or and I think a lot of Afrikaners couldn't accept that.
Who was that one who went in the 60s then to go and declare the Republic and said, we are the Republic, no longer English subjects?
That was Verwoerd. Hendrik Verwoerd. Yes.
Hendrik. Yeah.
Hendrik Verwoerd initiated the referendum in, was it 61, I
61,
think? Or
yes,
65,
yes.
Around there. It was in the 60s, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it was 61, yes. And then they had a referendum to vote. Do you want to, should South Africa be a republic or... Mm-hmm. Or be a union. Back mm-hmm. then they called it the Union of South Africa, which was then part of the British Empire. And
yes.
The majority voted in the 60% voted that it should be a republic. So there was this big celebration then.
Okay.
And a lot of Afrikaners think about Verwoerd today as the guy who got us out of the British Empire to become a republic.
Yes.
But I know a lot of other people think about Verwoerd today and they don't think about that. So, which goes again to how complicated history can be.
Yeah, I think one would say, and I'm just going to jump into another subject. One would say, maybe if there was a collective and a unified approach between you as the Afrikaners and the black indigenous people of the country, maybe South Africa will still have held that progress that we held pre, because I remember around the 60s towards the 80s, South Africa was leading in the world with innovation, with state-owned enterprises. We were the lovely darlings of the world. But then because of the apartheid policy, that's where then you had the division amongst your people. So maybe if you could have a unified one, South Africa would be more stronger if you had a common enemy, which was the British, and there was a unity between you and the local communities, and somehow finding a way to equally share the wealth and work together than to separate, because I think that division is what also opened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I think there's something beautiful in having a sense of pride in your culture, your language, your history. And there's also this fear, there has been and there still is, this fear among Afrikaner people that that we need to preserve this and this unique thing, this treasure that we have developed.
Yes.
There's a poem, one of our great Afrikaans poets, N.P. van Wyk Lowe, said that we have to carry the treasure that we have inherited through the crowd, which essentially means that we have this unique culture and language and we it's... And there's a crowd today and it's noisy and we need to protect it and we need to cherish it. And I think that's very good and it's healthy. I think that the risk comes in when you start thinking about that as instinctively being in animosity with others. So the fact that I want to protect what is mine
means
that everyone else is an enemy. Yes.
Okay.
And I think that's a very dangerous way of thinking and even though I wouldn't want to say that, I think many Afrikaners have made that mistake in the past. And I'm very proud, and I think we ought to be very proud as Afrikaners of that part of our history where we reached out to local African, black African communities and we cooperated. And there were many examples with the Zulu King Mpande and with Dini Zulu and many others in the past.
Yeah.
But... we don't tend to think about that or talk about that when we think about history. We think about the wars and we think about conflict.
Yeah, because I think me being born in the 90s, the history in my head is white and black.
Yes.
Afrikaners took our land, killed our people, and they still want to hold on to the wealth and they don't care. They just want to be in this small circle. But the history of how you were working with the certain kings to fight the British, how you were working towards the land. I mean, when I met AfriForum in the Eastern Cape, they are working with the kings in the Eastern Cape to build farms and all of that. I'm like, okay, there's cooperation on the ground, but it's not... It's hardly heard from the political space to say there's some level of working together. But then the question is, and I think maybe as you just said, the idea that the Afrikaner is under siege and needs to protect himself and needs to preserve themselves and everyone might be an enemy. You have Orania standing in the Northern Cape. And you've, as you always say, you didn't like apartheid. You voted against apartheid and this thing wasn't working. Isn't Orania a mini apartheid corner to say, okay, now we can have our own apartheid away from them. Let's build our own independent state. No blacks allowed. It's just us, the Afrikaner. Isn't that the mindset?
Well, let me start by saying I can't speak on Orania's behalf. I'm not a spokesperson for them and I don't live there.
Yeah, it's a conversation. Yeah.
Yes, but I think one of the things, let me just make a quick remark about what you said in your question, before I try to answer the question, you spoke about this part of the cooperation that isn't as well known. And I think that goes to to the way the media environment works today, which is, I think, very unfortunate, is the media and the whole concept of news thrives on friction. It thrives on conflict. And so someone once told me, there's this big question always, what's the definition of newsworthiness? And the most simple answer I could get was conflict or friction. Something is newsworthy when there's friction.
I'm in the media space, so they always say good news don't sell.
So when people fight, it's news. But when people cooperate, it's not, you know, good news stories, feel good stories don't work as well. And so when AfriForum, for example, that you mentioned and I was involved with, takes Julius Malema to court for hate speech, it's news. But when AfriForum reaches out to a local community and starts a joint cooperation project, a joint agricultural project, it's not news. And when they announce it, there's not 20 journalists showing up to cover the story. It's not as newsworthy, but it's probably more important. And so that's the problem with news today and the news cycle and the way it works is it thrives on conflict. And that's why you have all these people saying South Africa is on the verge of a race war, when I think South Africa is very far from a race war. But
isn't that because of there was a movement of there was a genocide of farm murders? You guys went to America and said there is farm murders, is genocide.
We've never said that there's genocide. Farm murders is a problem. It's a serious problem. When we raise concern about this, we get accused of saying that it's a genocide. And then if we get accused of that, the response is just prove that it isn't a genocide, as if once you prove that farm murders is not a genocide, the conclusion is, okay, it's not a problem. But it can be a problem without it being a genocide. So we're not into that game of trying to convince the world that there's a genocide in South Africa.
Okay, that makes sense. But coming back to Orania.
To Orania. Okay, so there was a saying in the 70s by Samora Machel from Mozambique, who made a speech, and he made the remark, he said something along the lines of, for the nation to prosper, the tribe must die.
Okay.
And there's some element of that in some of the ANC's works as well. No, there's much of that in the ANC's work, but there's some element of that in the early ANC comments as well. This thinking of cultural identity being a sort of a backwards thing. That's the old way of doing things, like a tribal identity. And we need to accept a new identity. And to Afrikaners, that's a big red flag. That's something when we hear that we're
like, no. We love who we are.
Because what we hear when people say that is that we cannot be who we are.
Must dilute your identity and just form part of this global form of,
Exactly. So Afrikaners are generally very proud of South Africa and proud South Africans, but when you hear this thing, when your Afrikaner identity is put as something that has to dissolve in order for the South African identity to flourish, then people go into backlash and they say no, but we need to preserve this identity, this treasure that we have inherited. And so, the Orania project is. I think it could be described as saying that there's not really a place in South Africa where Afrikaners are a majority. And there's some value.
But isn't that Krugersdorp and Randfontein?
No, we're not even there.
Because I grew up there and there's Afrikaners everywhere. You see the guys in shorts and, khakis. There's Afrikaners, a proper Afrikaner. You go to the West Rand, you go to Pretoria. I think that's where you have the majority.
In Pretoria East, there are many Afrikaners who live there, but they're not a majority.
True.
But there's some value in being a majority. In a particular area, that means that you can make certain decisions.
Common culture.
Yes. And I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to have that. Wanting to have some form of a space where you can have a degree of autonomy. You can have an area where you can build a city square, and there's a statue of Paul Kruger, and you're not concerned that someone is going to throw a Molotov cocktail at the statue or something.
Yes,
and I think that is to a large degree what Orania is trying to do, is to say that we need an area as Afrikaners where we have our own hub, you could say, or a cultural community.
A monument of who we are and where we come
yeah,
from.
Yeah, and where we can speak our language and not be pressured to speak English and so forth. Mm-hmm. And what frustrates us yeah. is that there are many such communities in South Africa. Mm-hmm. There are Nkandla is one. Nkandla is now controversial, but yeah. Nyameni in the Eastern Cape. And there are mm-hmm. cultural communities for all the cultural communities in South Africa, all the nations that make up South Africa.
Sure.
And when you hear someone talk, let's say in the media, of Nyameni, mm-hmm. they don't say the blacks only enclave Nyameni or the Khoza only community or something like that. They say it's a cultural community. But when you say Warania, then they say it's a whites only enclave.
But look at it this way, like Northwest. Botswana, as you know it, right, is the land of the Botswana. We pride ourselves with it. We had a kingdom there.
Yeah.
So imagine if we woke up one morning and said, this is going to be the land for the Tswana people. We don't need many of the Afrikaners. They must move out of here. It must be a Tswana place. And whoever's going to come here, they can only visit. But because of cultural differences, we don't want them. We just want to be Botswana. Mm. So if you are Zulu, Afrikaner, English, no, this is for the Tswanas only. Isn't that also? Because
yeah.
I think that's what Orania also, as much as it's a cultural village, it has a tone of, we don't necessarily welcome others to come and settle here. You can still have a majority,
yeah.
but why is it only exclusively for Afrikaners?
So I think an important difference is that Orania started out as a ghost town. It wasn't a community some intercultural community to start with. In the 1980s, it was a town that was, or some houses that were built by the Department of Waterworks in the previous century to build the dam there at Van der Kloof. Yes. And after the construction of the dam was finished, they left. So it was just empty buildings, which was then bought in, I believe, might have been the late 80s or the early 90s.
Yeah.
And they then said, let's take these empty buildings and let's start a cultural community.
Okay.
So it's not, no one was chased out or anything like that.
Yes.
There was nothing and it was developed into something.
But can Bafana move in with his family? That's the question.
The Warania answer would be if they identify with Afrikaner culture.
if I come there and singing Los Labi with my kakis, and maybe they'll be like, oh, he's one of us. Come in.
Well, they would have to answer that question, but it's a bit more complicated than that. So the notion behind Warania is it's privately owned.
Yes.
And it's a privately owned town. And to buy property is willing buyer, willing seller. I know that's a controversial term in South Africa.
Don't start now. Yeah.
but to say that we want to develop this area to be a cultural community, and if you buy into this project, then you are welcome. And I know, again, I can't speak for their behalf, but I know there has been some people in the past, ANC leaders and so forth, who have remarked that they want to move to Orania or buy property.
Yes.
And from what I've heard is that Orania then actually reached out to them and said, well, here's the application forms, fill in your form and then we can have a conversation.
Okay.
But then they don't apply. Mm. So I don't think, and I'm not speaking on their behalf, but I don't think there's ever been a case of someone actually applying to live in Warania, who said that I disagree with this Afrikaner project.
I mean, the thing, Ernest, for some people, they tend to view it, and I'm glad there is an education part of it here, to say it's just the Afrikaners who still remnants of apartheid and when they had power, and they can't stomach the idea of this South Africa that we're living in. And we have always seen these flags being raised up in Ventersdorp, where the former Afrikaner flag. To some people, they see that flag as very harmful to them. But to you, it's a pride thing. It's when you were in power. It's when you won wars and whatever, right? So it's a difficulty to say. When you raise that flag to a black person like Flip, they still want the apartheid back. But maybe to you, it's more about, this is our history. This is who we are. I mean, the AWB, what's his name, that guy?
Eugene Terblanche,
right? He was just anti-New South Africa, anti-democracy. Mm. And most Afrikaners at the time felt that he was right. Isn't that what inspired this? Isn't people who are in Orania mini Terblanches?
That's a good question. So firstly, I think the AWB has always been a fringe group within the Afrikaner community. I don't think they ever had more than 10% support, I think, at the mass height of their popularity. Mm. And secondly, I don't think the Oranje Blanje Blue flag is an Afrikaner flag. And some people might disagree, but I think the majority of Afrikaners don't see – some might, but I think the vast majority probably don't see that flag and think that's the Afrikaner flag. Mm. They think of it as a political flag, and it was a – it was in a way a compromise flag. You see the British flag is in it, and it's a flag, a big flag with three flags inside. Yes. So it's four flags in one. And so that's, to me, it's more a, and I think a lot of people would agree, a lot of Afrikaners would agree, that it's more a political flag than a flag that symbolizes Afrikanerdom. Okay. I think a flag, the flags that have more meaning in terms of Afrikaner identity would be the flags that the Boers fought against the British during the Anglo-Boer War. Mm-hmm. Like the Vierkleur, people think about, they hear the word Vierkleur and they think the orange, white, and blue flag. But the Vierkleur is actually another flag.
Okay.
That was the flag under which De La Rey fought against the British. So that says more about Afrikaner identity, mm-hmm, and the old Free State flag.
But yes.
So I wouldn't say that the old South African flag or the apartheid flag is symbolizes Afrikanerdom.
Okay.
But you asked
the question
about
Oranje and the guys, the mini terror blanches, and the ones who are anti-democracy, anti-Mandela, anti this whole idea of living together. Because some Afrikaners hold the view that we must get back the land. There are boys who have been trained in camps just in case there is a war.
So maybe if you would allow me to give you a somewhat philosophical answer, but I'll try to make it practical. But so the short answer is no, I don't think so.
Okay.
I know for a fact that the people living in Oranje are not AWB type people.
Okay.
I've seen people, at least on social media, mm-hmm, complaining, saying, I don't want to live in Oranje because I'm a racist and Oranje doesn't have place for racists like me. And I know people from Oranje who have come to Pretoria who've said that to them they see more white racism in other places in South Africa than they experience in Oranje. And
okay,
I think that, but so the philosophical side of the argument is, there's been some very horrible things happened in the previous century in,
yes,
South Africa and outside of South Africa,
true,
whether we're talking about communism or Nazism or all of these things. And there's a philosopher called, I think it was McIntyre, who said, no, it was Charles Taylor. Charles Taylor is a Canadian philosopher.
Yes.
Not the Liberian, there was a Liberian drug lord also called Charles Taylor, but it's
okay,
not the same one.
Yes.
But he said the problem with these atrocities in the previous century is that they held on to, or they identified some form of a good, something that is good.
Mm-hmm.
And in the form, with communism, that the good thing that they identified was that we need to help the working class.
Yes.
And with Nazism, the good thing that they identified is that we should be proud of who we are.
Mm.
And we can say with the Afrikaners, the good thing that we identified is we must do something to protect our culture.
Mm.
But then the argument then is the problem comes in when you try to pursue that good at the expense of all
others,
other goods.
Yes.
Yes. And the only way to really do that, and the Nazis are the best example, is you have to start destroying other goods, because other goods include cooperation between communities. Respect is also a good, and
yes,
and so forth. But when you only identify one good thing and you pursue that at the expense of all the other good things, you become evil. So that's the philosophical argument. And I think the reason why I mention this is some really bad things happened in South Africa in the past century.
Yes.
But they were, between these bad things, there were also some good things,
mm-hmm,
and one of these good things is the having a sense of cultural pride,
mm-hmm,
and now the concern that we have is this metaphor of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, saying,
yes,
we should never go back to where South Africa was,
mm-hmm,
and if we say, for example, that we should reject the notion of cultural identity,
mm,
that would be an example of destroying the good.
Mm.
That could be found among these bad things.
Mm.
And I think, and in that sense, I think Oranje is in many ways rejecting the apartheid system, rejecting, for example, the labor policies of the apartheid system and many aspects thereof.
Yes.
But the good thing that they are trying to preserve is to say there's nothing wrong with having a community or a village or a town where a particular cultural community can freely express their culture.
Because I think, and I get what you're saying, like the Zulus, they're very pride, they have the strong pride of their who they are.
Exactly.
But then they're not doing that in Natal by kicking out the Indians in order for them to have that cultural identity and preserve it. So I think maybe the debate becomes when it becomes a white only thing, right? To say you can still have it as a majority and do your culture, and but it doesn't have to be happen exclusively. But anyway, and we are going to the issue now of the thing. I'm looking at time. We have the GNU right now. There's always been a debate in South Africa. The black people have the political power, the whites have the economic power, and the poverty in this country, as they always say, there's a soundbite, the unequal society in the world. There's land issues, there's all of these things, the transfer of wealth and whatever, the freedom charter and all of that. As someone who's probably had a share of bit of both worlds, what would you say could be a benefit of the GNU right now to moving South Africa forward, to building this unity between our people, not just socially, but economically as well? How do we redistribute wealth? And how do we, because I mean, it's a time ticking bomb. It's a time ticking bomb, either way.
So can I say something about equality and the GNU? Because it's two things, but they get together. I think on the equality side, the government talks about the triangle of poverty, unemployment, and inequality.
Sure.
And I would say that, and it's not just me saying this, there's been a lot of research on this, that you can do something about poverty and you can do something about unemployment, but there's never been a successful attempt to eradicate inequality. In other words, in a society with a free market where people choose different occupations, there will always be some form of inequality, with some people earning more and some people earning less.
Okay.
It becomes complicated, and it becomes a matter of friction and tension when those earning more is identifiable, and in terms of what they look like, and those earning less is identifiable.
Okay.
So I would say that if the goal is to fix inequality, in other words, to make everyone equal in terms of income, that borders on a communist utopian dream that is not realistic. But if the goal is to fix the unemployment problem or poverty, to address poverty, that is something achievable.
I mean, I'm going to take it back to when you took back the state at the time as the Afrikaners. You used the state as somehow, we had an affirmative action for the Afrikaner people, and used the state to build what we had, enterprise and all of that. And you could uplift Afrikaners from poverty through the state. And the ANC has tried that, but I think they're trying it from a welfare angle, where they are giving your grants and whatever NS fast for free, but not necessarily building industries. So the question is, where do you think they got it wrong? Because you guys mastered it. You had a social grant.
Yeah.
You had all these things that they are trying to do, just that they are doing it from a welfare point of view. So it's not necessarily nation building.
Okay. I want to give a long answer, but I'm going to try to give you the short or the medium answer.
Yeah.
I think it's not that simple to say it was because of the state that the Afrikaners got uplifted from poverty. I think it would be wrong to say the state didn't play a role.
Sure.
But the state played a role more towards the second half of the previous century.
Okay.
After the war and after the Great Depression, there was massive poverty. And you couldn't really just levy taxes and get money by taxing people, because there wasn't much to tax. And so the Afrikaner people had this help mekaar beweging, or the help each other movement, which was bake sales, baking koeksisters and melktaart and selling it on the street and collecting funds, money to say we need to build a school. So this is how much money we need to build a school. So there was a strong
communal
entrepreneurial thing that had nothing to do with the government.
Okay,
I should say as this wealth, I think that was primarily the result of a communal effort to say, we as a community, we need to, there was a slogan at the time that said, a volk redt homself, a nation saves itself.
Yes.
So we need to save ourselves. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to work hard, and we're going to start our own businesses, and we're going to sell koeksisters on the street. And that eventually led to a point where the state could come in and start levying taxes, and then say, we're going to levy taxes and we're going to use this money to build Eskom or something.
Okay.
And there was a danger in that because, in a sense, we went from independence to dependence, to government dependence. That was one of the negative consequences of the apartheid system for the Afrikaner people.
Yeah.
Is we became dependent on the government as well.
Okay.
And I think the mistake that the ANC is making currently is to focus very much on the state and what the state ought to be doing, but not focusing on the community upliftment and providing an environment where it's easier to start your own business and these type of things. With all these regulations and upon regulations, making it very difficult to employ people and to start a business. I think if the labor policy and the economic policies were more open, that would have been a much better system.
Because some people are saying maybe when we took the state, we shouldn't have gotten rid of all the whites in the state. We should have kept some of them, and maybe we could have a good synergy while others are learning how to do it. There's also others who have experience in working together. But I think around after the Mandela's national government of national unity, you already saw was all black ministers, all black, even municipalities, whites literally disappeared from state functions. And did you think maybe that was...
I think so, yes. I think one of the mistakes they made was they basically fired all the DGs.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the minister and the DG. And the minister is, in a sense, the leader, the political leader, and the DG is the person who runs the department to execute the minister's goal. And a DG, at least in theory, is not supposed to be a political appointment, but just someone who can run the government.
Sure.
And I think that was one of the mistakes is they should have kept on the DGs at the time and to say, well, because with the DG comes a sense of continuity. Exactly.
Yes.
And now just firing everyone and replacing them with people who have never run a government department before creates a problem. I think that would have been that was a very practical thing they could have done differently.
Okay, my brother, I'm gonna leave you now. I'm thinking your time. I'm having a good conversation. I think we should have coffee even beyond this.
Yes,
just to have a full grasp, because our nation is going through a time where now with Gene there is this appetite for unity and working together. You know, we no longer pro this or pro that, but we are pro South Africa. I mean, with the Springboks as well winning, uniting the country, there's this unity that we need. But as AfriForum, what would be your message to South Africans or to Afrikaners as we're celebrating Heritage Month? The camera is behind me. You have a minute of fame. So in 3, 2, 1.
Well, thank you. Well, shall I look into the camera?
Yes.
All right. Well, let me just first say I can't speak on behalf of AfriForum, but I'm involved.
Yes. Yes, it's Afrikaner community.
Yeah, so let me clarify. Is it a message to the Afrikaner people?
The Afrikaner in South Africa is one thing.
Well, I think an important step for us going forward is recognizing cultural diversity. There's lots of talk about diversity and the importance thereof, but oftentimes we find in reality that diversity becomes a suppression of diversity and of cultural diversity. And if we can move towards a point where there's a greater appreciation of diversity and a greater extent of mutual recognition and respect, even on things on which we disagree, I think that would be a very big and a very important step forward.
Yes, that's it from Ernest Rhodes. It's important that as South Africans, we embrace our heritage. We embrace also our unique cultures. Most of us are Tswanas, Pedi, Tsongas, Ndebeles. As we embrace the idea of a unified South Africa, let it not also be a dilution of our cultures and where we come from. Other than that, that's it from VVIP, proudly brought to you by a podcast party where great minds don't think alike. I am Bafana Modise. See you next time. Ciao, ciao.